us, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this September 1st, 2010 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. Today, there's a lot of information on the publishing world. I'm pleased to be joined now by John McNally, and coming up in the second half hour, literary agent Ted Weinstein will be here. John McNally is the author of three novels, After the Workshop, The Book of Ralph, and America's Report Card, and two-story collections, Troublemakers and Ghosts of Chicago. He has edited six anthologies, including Humor Me, an anthology of humor by writers of color, and his fiction, book reviews, and essays have appeared in more than 100 publications. A native of Chicago's South Side, John is an associate professor of English at Wake Forest University. His latest book is The Creative Writer's Survival Guide, Advice from an Unrepentant Novelist. It's published by Iowa. It's a wonderful and extremely helpful guide to add to your writerly bookshelf, and it's my pleasure to welcome him this morning. John, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, Marie.
Oh, you know, I should say welcome back, because I know you were on the show with Barbara a while back with After the Workshop, yeah?
Right.
Yeah. You know, I know before we dive into the new book, when she was chatting with you, she had wanted to talk about dialogue, because you've got such a great ear for it, and you know, I've just noticed your dialogue rings so true, and it, you know, it doesn't say too much, like it's, you know, dictation or something, but it really carries an authentic tone while advancing the story. So I was hoping we could start there with a few dialogue tips and tricks and how to get it right.
Oh boy, one of the things I do is I read my work out loud endlessly, and so, and part of it, I think, is just paying attention to the rhythm of it, paying attention to the cadence, of what the characters are saying. And I think just, you know, paring away too, so that you're, you know, I feel that sometimes it's easy in a first draft to go too long with dialogue, and to keep stripping it back, and also knowing when to intersperse summarized dialogue, you know, because not every bit of dialogue is interesting.
Right.
So trying to figure out how to balance that. But for me, I grew up listening. And I was probably an odd child. I mean, I grew up in the 70s. I was born in 65, but I used to listen to vaudeville records. And I feel that helped in some ways give me a sense of timing with dialogue, because there's the rapport of when you have the vaudevillian, you have the straight man and the comic, and the rapport of going back and forth has to be this very, very quick, you know, sharp-witted rapport. And I feel like in some ways that although I wasn't planning on being a fiction writer when I was in third grade, but just listening to that and memorizing those sorts of routines, I think helped me in some way.
That's great advice. That's great advice. So let's talk about the new book. Tell me a little bit about it for those that haven't picked it up yet, and how you decided to write it.
Well, it's not a craft book, as I say in the introduction. It's what it is essentially is, you know, I've given, you know, over 100 readings, and there are always the Q&A sessions afterwards. And what I attempted to do with this book was to answer every question I've ever been asked in a Q&A. So that has to do with publishing, that has to do with the writer's life, has to do with education. In the book, I tried to divide the book up into five different sections so that it begins with, you know, really kind of asking those initial questions, the decision to become a writer, and, you know, and asking yourself, why do you want to do this, and, you know, what do I have to write about, and things like that. And then moving on to talk about education and the writer, getting published, publicity, and the last part, well, actually it's six parts in the book, employment for writers, and then the last part, the writer's life. But I didn't want it to be this kind of wonkish book of facts and statistics. I wanted it to be a highly opinionated book, so people can disagree with me as they read parts of it, but it's based on essentially my 22 years of doing this, or trying to do this professionally, and having published and, you know, begun in literary magazines, and having gone through an MFA program and then later a PhD program and so on. But the book came about because my the publisher at University of Iowa Press, who published my first book, Troublemakers, approached me, and she had seen on my website that I had this page of writing advice that was just very kind of informal but to the point, and trying to be very honest about difficulties that writers have and face. And she said, well, what about doing an entire book like this? And I immediately said yes, because I just, you know, it's just the idea appealed to me in some ways, if for no other reason than to have collected all of the answers that for questions that people might have for me. So now I can just hold up the book.
It is amazing because, you know, I mean, the book is sort of a reflection of this show in a lot of ways, and the questions that we get asked here and the questions that we try to address over and over. And so it's just this this great, you know, every time I flip to a new section, a new page, I was like, you know, here it is. You know, every question that we have, it is. It's right here. It's great. So I think the best way to go about this is to just pull out some of it to kind of tease our listeners into wanting more, and you know, some of the things that we get asked a lot, and that I know you get asked a lot. And you know, it's hard to even know where to begin because there's so much. But let's start with new writers you know, where to begin if a writer wants to write a novel. They haven't been published before. They have no credits to their name. They haven't been through an MFA program, and have, you know, they don't have any contacts. Where do they start? Where do you recommend they begin?
Well, you know, I first of all, I do think it's always good to get feedback, and I talk about the difference between criticism and feedback in the book. And so, criticism being essentially somebody saying this doesn't work, but not necessarily being helpful about it. But getting feedback to get people's reactions, what they think is happening in the novel, why they think certain things are happening. And so I think even before getting to the stage of trying to get an agent for a published book, I would try to get some trusted readers. And by trusted readers, I mean hopefully some readers who have more experience than you with writing books, and certainly there are, you know, even if you don't go through an MFA program, usually most towns have some sort of writers group of some kind to try to connect up with them to get some feedback. But also sometimes there are community courses through college or private workshops that are taught. Just to get enough feedback, because I think it's invaluable to try to get those people to read the book. I do think too, this is the catch-22 I talk about in the book. Agents don't want short story collections, and so and I do think most people are either short story writers or novelists. If few people do both, I think with equal success. But then on the other hand, agents are much more likely to be enthused by somebody who has credits, and chances are those credits are going to be from short story publications. Mm. So if there's a way that you can get some publications, I would certainly recommend doing that. Maybe there are parts of your book that are excerptable. What was essentially my first published novel, which was called The Book of Ralph, was really just a collection of short stories that were interlinked, and I published all of those stories as individual, all those chapters as individual short stories in magazines. And I think that helped in some way to give the book some credibility and also to give it some cohesion. But I could also go out with it and say, when I approached an agent for that book, to say, these chapters have appeared in these magazines. And I think that helps as well.
Yeah, that's always been one of my questions is, it does feel like people are either short story writers or novelists, but, it does help to have at least a body of something that you can say, has appeared somewhere, and those usually are short stories, so it does kind of seem like a catch-22 to me, too, and there's great information in here on publishing in literary magazines, why to do it, how to do it. Like I said, there's just a wellspring of stuff in here. It's great. Let's talk about some of the myths, maybe, that writers still harbor. You touched on a lot of them in here, but, that writing is subjective, and so, maybe I just haven't found the right the right reader for my work when, in reality, right, there are good writers and there are bad writers, and, once you read enough of them, you can really see it. But, and some myths on, talent, and you either have it or you don't, myths on the importance of grammar. Can we talk about a couple of those that you hear recurring writers or seasoned writers or new writers talk about, myths that just turn out not to be the case?
Well, I think for me, the biggest myth, and I certainly run across this with my students, is we're sort of waiting for the muse. My students will say, well, I need to be, I need to wait for inspiration. And what's interesting is I asked a handful of writers just a general question when I was working on this book. I said, what's your best advice for young writers? And almost all of them came back with the same thing, which was to write every day and to work every day and to come up with a schedule. And they said it in different ways, but there was a common thread that, nobody said, sit around and wait for the muse. So for me, I feel that writer's block is a myth of sorts. It's, nobody talks about exercise block when they don't go to the gym. it's just laziness or apathy or something. And so, but for writers, I think it's sometimes an excuse not to write. And so one of the suggestions I have is to have several projects going at once, so that if you do get stuck, and I do think people do get stuck, so I believe that there are points at which you kind of hit a wall, but that you can pick up and begin working on another project. And my other belief too is that the best way to write yourself out of so-called writer's block is is to write, or the best way to get out of writer's block is to write. You know, the people who say that, the writers who say that, oh, this short story or novel wrote itself, it was a gift. I think the reason it wrote itself is because they had been writing every day for a number of years, and a number of projects didn't necessarily work. You know, speaking from my own experience, I've written several unpublished novels, but I felt that those were necessary in order to write the books that did get published. So, you know, so even if you're working on something that ultimately doesn't materialize into a published book, I don't think it's without value.
Yeah.
I think you have to get through that. I had a teacher who always said the bad work's connected to the good work, and I believe that. The problem is that sometimes you don't know that you're writing the bad work.
Right.
And it's disheartening and it's depressing when you find out that maybe that is the case, but I think you just have to keep pushing on.
Right, right. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. I'm speaking with John McNally. The book is The Creative Writer's Survival Guide. It's published by Iowa. You touched on this a little bit before, but I wanted to go back to it in writing workshops and the importance of being in a workshop. That's actually how I got started. I took a class here at UCI with Barbara and joined her private workshop. So I think you're exactly right. The community colleges and universities are great ways to get started. But you also talked about the plight of becoming the professional student or the workshop junkie. you know, when you've workshopped too much and when you're using it as a crutch as opposed to a way to advance your work. And I hoped you could talk about that for just a minute.
Sure. I mean, I worry about people who can't stop taking workshops, only because I feel that at a certain point you have to trust your own intuition. And you know, the workshop, I think, is good at the beginning in terms of giving you that initial feedback and helping you figure out, you know, I hate to say your own voice, but to figure out what works for you best as a writer and to feel more confident in writing and also to give you that structure of writing every day. But I think sometimes people will continue taking many, many workshops over many, many years, and what happens sometimes is that, you know, it's because they feel that they can't have a deadline without the workshop. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I hear a lot. And I sort of feel like, well, you need to be able to set your own deadlines. You know, you shouldn't have to have a workshop to do it. But the other thing that I worry about is that if you're constantly just simply revising to please a workshop, then that's not going to ultimately, I think the laws of diminishing returns kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're constantly trying to please, you know, probably a different group every semester. And the thing I tell my students, you know, at any given time, a workshop or a discussion of a story, it may be anywhere from 2% to 98% valuable. So, I mean, it's a pretty wide range, and I would hate to rely on that for everything I write. You know, at some point, you know, hopefully you become more intuitive about your own work in terms of what's working and what's not.
Yeah, I guess that's a good question, is knowing what advice to take and what advice to leave behind. And you know, maybe that is just doing this over a course of, you know, months or years and learning what makes sense and learning what's destructive. I get the sense that a lot of these workshops are certain feedback is really not helpful, and people spend a lot of time revising something they probably shouldn't. You know, they revise the magic out of it, perhaps. I guess if you get a consensus going of, you know, 30 people telling you the same thing, it's obvious. But sometimes it's not so
obvious. Yeah, and I think the same is true when you submit to a magazine or you submit a novel to agents. I mean, you'll hear contradictory advice. I've had stories where one editor will say, you know, we love the beginning, but the ending doesn't work, and the next editor says the ending's great, but the beginning doesn't work, and so you know. Either you're going to go insane trying to solve that problem, or you have to just say, okay, this editor's right, or they're both wrong. and hopefully, you know, I think part of the workshop is just gaining the experience of reading a lot of work and becoming good at troubleshooting those sorts of things, you know. But it shouldn't be this problem-solving body for every single thing that you do.
Yeah, yeah. You had a great section in here on, do you have what it takes to be a writer, and this love of sentences. And It distilled things down, as you said the first time you heard, you know, do you like sentences? Does it come down to that you thought it was silly, but the longer you think about it, the more true it becomes. Talk about that for just a second. I thought that was a great section.
Well, I think as a writer, you have to love language, and I think you, and also just to be able to read a sentence in a book and appreciate it and say, wow, you know, that's a, you know, like to see all the different things that a sentence may do. I mean, the sentence that I always bring to my classes to write up on the board is the first sentence of 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And it's a wonderful sentence because it does so many things. It implies and infers all kinds of things that aren't necessarily there yet. It establishes the scope of the book. It gives you a sense of past, present, and future. So time-wise, it's doing some interesting things. And if you can't appreciate that, I think you have a problem with you're going to have a problem with your own work in some ways. And I think, you know, and again, this is sometimes I worry about, you know, sometimes, and I teach primarily undergraduates, I should say. But there are students who are drawn to writing because they like the idea of it, not because they read as much as they should or have an appreciation of language as much as they think that they should. So, you know, it does seem like a silly criterion to say, you know, do you like sentences? But I think ultimately it does boil down to that. You know, I mean, I find that the writers that I really like, you know, I love their stories, but I also appreciate them from a writer's standpoint too, where I can stop and say, wow, you know, I wish I could do that. That's just an amazing thing that this writer's done in this particular sentence or this passage.
Yeah, it is amazing to me how many writers say, I don't have time to read, and, you know, that they don't read as much as they should.
Well, and I feel that if you don't have time to read, then nobody's gonna have time to read your work.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you need to be a reader to be a writer.
Right, right. My guest is John McNally. The book is The Creative Writer's Survival Guide. Let's talk about the kind of the future of publishing, where it's going. You had a nice section in here on print on demand versus self-publishing versus some small houses. The industry is obviously changing rapidly here. Can you talk a little bit about where you see things going and what advice you give writers in this kind of, you know, new state of affairs?
Oh, I wish I could. this is the part, and I'm sure, and I admit in the book that I probably come off as a Luddite in some way, even though I'm not. I work on a computer and everything, but I do get depressed by the idea of the book as an object disappearing. And I also get depressed, I think, a little bit by, you know, I would hate to see the publishing industry follow the music industry in the sense that there's a quote that I have in here by Tom Petty where he talks about how, you know, getting a record contract and cutting a record back in the 70s kind of meant something. And now the problem is, he felt, was that, you know, there's great music out there, but it's hard to find because everybody, everywhere, you know, has a CD. And so I don't really, you know, I'm not sure. This is the million-dollar question, I think, which is where publishing is heading. And I think in some ways, you know, it can be exciting because it gives more access, you know, certainly to a lot of people who may not be able to afford books, for example. But, you know, with Internet publishing and web journals and things like that. But at the same time, I have to say, I mean, one of the things that drew me into writing in the first place as a child was my love of books, ordering those Scholastic books, you know, where I would just check off, and then the teacher would bring this gigantic box of books, and then I would have to tell my mother how much money I spent. But it was the book as an object that drew me, I think, initially into loving books as, you know, just as an aesthetic thing.
Right, right. Yeah, I assume it's now more incumbent upon writers to do more of their own marketing, and, you know, you hear now that writers need more of a platform and everybody should have a blog and a website, and, you know, I assume that's all true, but I don't know. The rules of the game seem to be changing so quickly here.
It is, and I think too. I have a website. I used to have a blog. I used to have I used to be on, you know, Facebook, and then I decided that all of that was such a time suck away from what it is I wanted to do, and I just felt that, which was right. And so, you know, the marketing part of it is very tricky. I mean, as I mentioned in the book, my most successful book signing was at an Italian beef sandwich stand in Chicago, where I grew up. It's like trying to match the subject of your book in some way to a unique place that can garner the kind of attention or publicity that giving a reading at, say, Barnes & Noble might not.
Mm-hmm.
I've done plenty of readings at Barnes & Noble, many of which two or three people show up, and I think those people show up because they're lonely or, bored, or they just happen to be sitting there and feel guilty, you know, they don't want to get up and leave. You know, so I think, like, trying to find innovative ways of publicizing your book becomes more and more important, especially as marketing money diminishes, especially with, I mean, it's always been, I think with smaller houses, you've always had to be innovative, but certainly with commercial houses now, it's, you know, there's less and less marketing money and fewer book tours.
Right, right. Unfortunately, we're drawing down on our time, but with that depressing thought in the backdrop, is there any other advice that you give either for established or new writers, or, you know, kind of the, I guess what we were just talking about, any more advice given the state of where things are going?
Well, I you know, I think one of the quotes that I have in the book is by Jonathan Messenger, who, he's publisher of a very small house called Featherproof Books, and he's a writer himself, and I think one of the things he says is a quote I use in the book is that he says, you're a writer, not a publicist, so have fun with it, and whatever publicity you do should be a creative act of some kind.
Mm.
And I think just going back to, and this is the thing I have to remind myself, is when I start getting bogged down with all of these, you know, how can I sell more books? How can I do this? Is to remind myself why I'm doing this in the first place, and it's because I love to write, and I feel that it's so long as I'm getting that pleasure out of it, you know, that is actually satisfying. Of course, I'd like for the book to be published, and I'd like for it to, you know, become a bestseller. But that stuff is really kind of out of my hands in a lot of ways. I mean, that's. So, you know, I think if you are going to do publicity for your book, try to have fun with it. Try to come up with something interesting. I mean, one of the ideas I like is this: doing book tours or doing signings of people's houses. You know, where it's sort of like those old candle parties or old, you know, things like that, where people invite friends over to do signings, and, you know, something like that. Don't turn it into a chore.
You know, I do have to say that that's one of the things that comes through in all of your work, is it looks like you're having fun, and you know, and that really draws the reader in. I mean, it's you know, the humor helps, but it just looks like you're having a great time with it, and so I think that's great advice. I think that's great advice. I also want to give you a chance to mention the website. The website is great. It's Book of Ralph, R-A-L-P-H, bookofralph.com, named after one of your books. And if you're interested in finding more about John, his work, his advice, I recommend you go on there, bookofralph.com. John, this was a huge pleasure. I so appreciate this.
Oh, thanks. Thanks again for having me on.
Thanks again. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Literary agent Ted Weinstein will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
None of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays, 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under Talk News on iTunes. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and lots of other stuff. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Ted Weinstein. Ted is an AAR member literary agent with broad experience on both the business and editorial sides of publishing. Before founding his agency nearly a decade ago, he held senior positions with several major publishing companies. Also a widely published author, Ted has been the music critic for NPR's All Things Considered and a commentator for many periodicals. It is my pleasure to welcome him this morning. Ted, hi.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Why don't we start by you talking about how you found your way into agenting? Because I know you took sort of a circuitous route and had a career before this. So talk a little bit about that, how you came to it.
Well, I always like to joke that I'm a recovering writer, and I've done a lot of writing in my past, and I must say that my grammar is quite functional, but beyond that, my writing is workmanlike at best, and so though I had a lot of fun with it and I learned a lot, it was pretty quickly evident that writing is not the way I should be making my living, and I shouldn't be subjecting strangers to my writing. But in the course of learning a lot, and in the course actually of querying some agents for a book I'd taken some time off to write, it was actually two other agents who sat me down under the guise of it being just a social lunch, and by the end of the lunch they'd sort of looked at each other, winked, turned back to me and said, "We've decided you're going to be an agent." And because I'd done lots of different things in publishing in addition to the writing, I'd worked in a number of different publishing and communications roles. And the agents, this was, as you said in your introduction, almost a decade ago, said, "What do you think agents do all day? We do marketing, we do editing, we do business development, we do licensing, we do all of these different functions for authors. And you've done many of those things. The agencies are becoming even more vital to the industry, and we think you've got the basics. So get started." And at a certain point, when enough other people tell you to do something, it's foolhardy to argue. You just go off and do it.
I love it. I sit around waiting for signs like that in my own life, but so rarely do they come. That's a great story.
I think there are actually lessons for writers in that as well. And when I teach my book proposal boot camp, which is just a beginning to end, how do you do a book proposal? A big part of it is not about the proposal itself, but helping authors think through what's their motivation for what they're trying to do here. John actually said pretty much everything I have to say, so we might as well end the interview now. But he ended it on, as you pointed out, a somewhat of a downer note. And that's what I'll often try to do, is spend the first chunk of my time with a group of writers saying, this is miserable, it's getting worse, you run away now. But then, once I've gotten everybody in the room to raise their hand and say, yep, we're really depressed and hopeless, then to say, okay, now let's look at the new future, and that there really are opportunities here. And I think that for every writer, having a board of directors or a committee or whatever you want to call it, of folks that are great guides for them, great counselors and coaches for them, is essential. Mm-hmm. I don't want to sound too Northern California about it, and there's nothing New Age about this at all. I just think that in aggregate, the people around us who know us best know us better than we know ourselves. And those people can actually be professional contacts. Doesn't necessarily need to be just your parents, your kids, your family, your dog. It can also be folks you meet through the writing world. But whatever that group is, treat them seriously, ask them for advice, listen to what they have to say.
So tell me a little bit about the books you like to work on and what your agency represents.
I represent only nonfiction, in part because to me fiction is magical and I can't imagine how anybody would edit it. That to me is like editing a painting. And also so that I can have the pleasure of reading a novel without feeling like I have to make marginal notes all the time. So I focus only on nonfiction, but within that realm, a pretty broad range, roughly about a third serious narrative. History, biography, current affairs, popular science, that sort of storytelling. About a third, very practical books, news you can use, business, health, cooking, personal finance, a whole range of very practical information. And then a third that's harder to characterize because it's more sort of in the realm of pop culture, often web-based projects, just the sort of quirky project that nobody could predict in advance, but some uniquely creative individual popped up with a great idea and developed something that works very well in book form.
It strikes me that in the nonfiction realm, you have to be a little bit more conscious of the market than you do in, you know, I just love this book. And, you know, in the fiction world, you hear of agents say, I just love this book and I wanted to sell it. For you, it sounds more like what sells, what can I sell, as opposed to the more subjective what you love. Is that how you choose books, or...?
I think you're right in a general sense about slight difference between fiction and non, but in this day and age, as always, but especially now, publishing is a business. And I think there's only so much fiction anybody in the industry can work with if there isn't also some reasonable likelihood of commercial success. And in nonfiction, I've represented books that have sold for many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars and have been bestsellers around the world. I've also worked with clients on books that had a much smaller audience that have sold, excuse me, for more modest advances and in smaller numbers. But the author and I and the readers loved that project as well. So although often you'll get into a group of publishing folks and they'll say, oh, I do this for love. That's a lovely statement, but I also do this for money. This is how I make my living, which is true of most people in the industry. The days of sort of dilettantes with a trust fund have pretty much diminished. So I think we all want to love what we work on, but we are also very well aware, whether on the fiction or nonfiction side, that publishing is a business, and the success in numbers is a marker really at core for how many readers did the author reach. Mm-hmm. And I think that's every author's goal, is to reach the widest possible readership.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Ted Weinstein, literary agent. So tell me about the emerging areas or trends in nonfiction over the course of the last 10 years that you've been doing this, how things are changing and where things are going.
I think everybody is watching the electronic world and wondering what effect it's going to have. I think there's a lot of preliminary guesses, but at the moment, the percentage of books that are being sold as e-books is still very small. We all see a wave coming, but I think at this point, everybody is just making their best guesses. The other part of electronic publishing, though, that I think is not being discussed enough is print-on-demand. And I think that some combination, both are based upon the notion of electronic distribution. And I think that is a fundamental change that is threatening the existing business models, especially for the publishers, but also for the agencies and for authors.
Yeah.
But I think it also then provides new opportunities. It was funny, I got my start in, quote, the content world 15 years ago when the Internet was first becoming a consumer medium. And everybody was buzzing about the word disintermediation, as if all of a sudden there'd be a direct line between two ends of the universe. The equivalent today would be saying that, great, every author is going to have a direct relationship with readers. That is theoretically true. For readers who are, your listeners rather, who have heard about this, Seth Godin made a big pronouncement, as he always does about anything he does, but he made a big pronouncement about he's no longer going to work with his major publisher and will just work directly with his readers and find ways to reach them. That is a lovely goal. He can probably execute that, but that's after decades of working through traditional channels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the notion of disintermediation is a lovely phrase which means nothing. The real issue is what's the re-intermediation? And I think between a first-time author and their first-time reader of that author, there will be new intermediaries springing up that are providing value both to the author and to the reader. To the author, it's folks that can help them be better writers, package their material better, get the word out better about what they're up to. And for readers, it's going to be some existing and or new intermediaries that help them find the writers they're going to be most interested in that they wouldn't have heard about otherwise. So the roles will continue. Electronic distribution means, I believe, there are going to be whole new people stepping into both of those roles. And still, at the end of the day, it's going to be a great writer sitting down and writing something that eventually touches a reader very deeply.
Yeah. It's interesting, this new arm of Amazon where, you know, you can self-publish, and if you're selling well enough, Amazon will find you and publish you that way. You know, I follow a lot of, you know, random blogs and word of mouth on the internet. So it does seem like there are new and different ways that books are getting out there. But I think you're right. That's really an uphill battle for new writers to try and do it that way.
But that also is not new. I've had several clients who self-published their book initially and had the kind of success that was indicative of even larger opportunity with a major publisher. So I have a client by the name of Peter Montoya who wrote a book called The Brand Called You, which actually isn't focused on writers, though the core premise is, of course, important to writers and everybody else who's working on their own. He self-published the book, sold 65,000 copies around the world. And then, at that point, knew that to get it to the next level of distribution and marketing opportunity, he made the choice to take, obviously, a lower royalty per unit, but to work with a major publisher. So I sold the book for him at that point to McGraw-Hill, and the book has gone on to even greater success.
Amazing, amazing.
So now that is in the pre-electronic world. If you do well by yourself, and there's an opportunity for a major publisher to take you even bigger, those opportunities are always going to be there.
Yeah, yeah. My guest is Ted Weinstein. He is the literary agent. And tell me about, on the content side, emerging trends in nonfiction content-wise, what the new trends are, where the new areas of kind of hot topics are.
I'd be happy to talk about that, but first I want to give a caveat that for most, almost every author, trying to write to the trends is a foolish errand.
Mm-hmm.
One, because for almost every writer, writing what you know or love or have some experience with means you're just going to do a better job.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, even with new electronic tools, book publishing is rightly a slow process. And so to be trying to jump on the latest celebrity incident to write a book, there are always going to be a couple of those books that are crashed to market. But for, I would assume, almost everybody listening today and almost every serious author out there, it makes more sense to get really good at your topic, your craft, build your own presence in the world, and the world will beat a path to your door, or at least when you go out there into the world, there's going to be some receptiveness. That said, though, I think the one category that's changed that's new in the past 10 or 15 years is the notion of micro-histories or concept histories or books about nouns. You can call them whatever you will. There have always been wonderful celebrity bios. There have always been thrillers. You can go through every category of writing that you see on the bestseller list. Those have existed for all time. More recently, though, started a while back with the book Longitude by David Sobel, there's now those really intimate books that tell the story of an object. And through that, it's a lens to something larger. That's a little bit new, although we're starting to run out of nouns. So I hope if anybody's listening today who can think of a noun about which a book hasn't yet been written, please contact me. There might be a market opportunity there for us. But within that, I think the core lesson is humans haven't changed in a very long time. We may dress differently, our sense of aesthetics may change, but a wonderful book I highly recommend is by Michael Korda, the grand editor from formerly of Simon & Schuster, who wrote a book called Making the List. And what he did was he went through, I believe it was Publishers Weekly's bestseller lists for the entire 20th century, basically. And he showed that in every decade, the bestseller lists have the same kind of books. Mm. It's all the same human interests that are reflected in the books that are most popular. Same as with movies or music or anything else.
Mm, I love that. I love that. Great advice. I love the advice on, you know, just following what you're interested in and digging into a subject matter and not trying to follow trends, because I hear this over and over again of people trying to predict the market, and it's such a losing, I think it's such a losing battle, but that's great. I also want to mention your website is fabulous, twliterary.com. In particular, there are two talks you give that you've alluded to before, this boot camp on book proposals, and there's one on there on fiction. Both of those talks, I think, are really invaluable for people. Any writer, really. I mean, there's just endless advice on there that I thought was really fabulous.
And if anyone's having trouble sleeping, they're wonderful soporifics.
No, they're really wonderful. And in one of those talks, you had mentioned academic presses wanting to do more publishing, and I think that's a market that people don't necessarily think about. That you know, beyond Simon & Schuster, there are a lot of other presses that are out there that people should be tapped into. Tell me also a little more about self-publishing and your thoughts on that going into the future.
I think the opportunities for authors are wider and wider. But again, the first question for an author should be, what is it you're trying to accomplish? The venues for anybody to basically share the contents of their head are now literally infinite. As you were discussing earlier with your previous guest, John, whether it's a blog, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Tumblr, whether it's print on demand, whether it's Scribd, there are more ways than anybody could count just to share your thoughts and to share your words. And in fact, let me recommend a different boot camp. I guess that's the phrase du jour or du year, but the self-publishing boot camp, which is taught by two real self-publishing experts here in the Bay Area, and I believe they're going to start taking it nationally. And that's just selfpubbootcamp.com, all one word. And they go in depth into every aspect of what self-publishing is all about, which is not just the writing, it's not just the formatting for a screen, but all the other elements that go into being literally a self-publisher. And that means taking on lots of roles that are currently fulfilled by agents and or publishers themselves. So the opportunities are enormous, and I think what's important is that anybody think through very carefully. If they're looking for the validation of a major publisher, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to sell more copies or make more money. But if that's what you want, that's fine. Then you need to go through the right channels to try to pursue that opportunity. If instead you want to just try to build your own audience and maximize your own revenue from that directly, self-publishing may be the opportunity. If you're looking for the right editorial relationship, as you mentioned a few moments ago, sometimes an academic press is the right place to go. Many of them, although obviously troubled by the decline in public financing these days in every realm, some of them are continuing to do remarkably good work in areas that we would consider trade publishing, aiming at a general audience, not aiming at an academic audience. So ever more research is necessary for an author, but ever more opportunities are out there.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Ted Weinstein, the head of the Ted Weinstein Literary Agency. As the publishing world is evolving and changing and, you know, perhaps shrinking, tell me about the evolving role of the agent and how your job has changed in response to what's been happening in the industry, how your relationships with your clients have changed, and, you know, if your role is a new one or if it's sort of being held constant despite the changes around you.
Well, everything I now am about to say, of course, will sound self-serving, but you've asked me to speak what I believe, so I'm not going to be shy about that. I think that increasingly the agencies are going to take on a larger and larger role in the industry. What those roles are going to become exactly is still up for grabs. But I'll share with you a quote from many, many years ago by Salman Rushdie, who at the time had been writing and publishing for maybe 20, 25 years. And he said he had had more editors than he could even remember, but he'd only had one agent that entire time. So the notion of the agent author relationship being the primary relationship for most authors, that's actually not new. But the roles that we're taking on for authors have been increasing, particularly as especially the major publishers have been functionally outsourcing more and more of what they used to do. That in some ways, agenting, which is a relatively new innovation, is in part outsourcing the scouting to somebody else. But publishers over time have been obviously outsourcing the literal printing. Many of them outsource their distribution to others. Often they're hiring freelance editors, freelance page designers, freelance cover designers. Big corporations, for their own appropriate benefit, do this very often in lots of realms. But what that's doing is, and no surprise to anybody listening, it's putting more and more of the burden on the author. And in turn, because authors' real expertise should be in the writing and the reporting of whatever they're working on, a lot more of those roles have been absorbed into agencies. So what I do as an individual, or what a few of the much larger agencies do with hiring additional staff, is editorial work, helping out on the publicity, brand building for the author over time, career counseling, many, many, many different functions. So in some ways, it's often helpful to think metaphorically. Look at another industry, like the movie industry. Over time now, when you look at the major studios, they are really not doing much other than financing and distributing a major film. The rest of the work is now done by the producers, who assemble the acting talent, the directing talent, the script, the craft people, and so on. They package something up, go to a studio, and get it financed. And that is not an identical overlap, but very close to what is becoming more and more common in book publishing.
We hear a lot about the importance of platform in nonfiction writing. You talk about this in your boot camp speech as well. Tell me about the importance of platform, how to establish it, what you recommend authors do to build it, and a little bit about that.
It's funny, authors often come to agents and say, great, you know, get me my first book deal and then I'll be famous. And our rejoinder is, no, first get famous and then I'll get you your book deal. And somewhere between those two mindsets is the reality for most authors who have real potential. There is no one bit of information or advice I can give. Every author's got different strengths, is working in a different realm. But the key is to think very dispassionately, very professionally about how many people know who I am, respect what I do. There's a wonderful concept that started to get publicized by Kevin Kelly about 10,000 true fans. And the notion is that if you want to live a creative life, that you can probably do that in many different realms of the arts. If you can build an audience and cultivate that audience of 10,000 true fans who will follow anything you do in your creative life. And by follow, I mean they'll buy your album or your book or go watch your movie or whatever it is. That's the scale, that's a threshold. With the new electronic publishing tools, that may be even more easily sustainable because you can reach those people directly without too many intermediaries. Once you get with an even larger fan base than that, whether you're writing for a major periodical, getting your voice out on National Public Radio, whatever it is, then there's even bigger opportunities, often through the corporate channels that do exist today. But either way, the mindset should be, before you even think about what are the right ways to reach people, hey, who am I? What do I have to offer? Who are the right people that should know about me already? And then the book and the playing cards and the cocktail napkins and the calendars and however many other ways you find to exploit your wisdom, those will all come in due time.
I love it. Any last-minute words of advice that we haven't covered so far? Well, I'm sure there's lots of advice we haven't covered so far, but... if you can distill it down to a minute or two.
A couple of things. One is, the most important is, just for authors who want to treat this like a real profession, act with a sense of professionalism. Agents are always astonished by the folks who approach us in the wrong way, don't do their homework, treat something as an off-the-cuff attempt at whatever, instead of saying, hey, this is something I want to do and get paid for, this is something I want to succeed at. Act like a professional, and the industry will treat you accordingly. The second is to just do lots of research. Every agency has a great website right now. We all have an enormous array of information we offer authors. We all tell you a lot about ourselves. be self-possessed as an author, look at all that's out there, and then make very informed decisions about which agents you'll want to query so that you'll only be talking to folks you might actually want to work with when the opportunity arises.
That is great advice. I want to mention your website again is twliterary.com. Again, there's a lot of information on there, but those two talks I really do recommend. They really are fabulous in a lot of different ways. Ted, this was a huge pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time this morning.
No, I'm delighted to do it. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks again. That was Ted Weinstein. His website, again, twliterary.com. You can find more information about Ted, the types of work his agency represents there, as well as those two great talks. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'll be back with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.